This is the Music History In-Depth podcast for April 23rd through the 29th. On this week's show, we have an iconic album, an iconic nightclub, and a bunch of icons, all of whom helped shape not only the music industry, but also the world. This show goes more in depth about some of the events that we put on our daily podcast, the Music History Today podcast, which drops every single day, including weekends, wherever you get your podcast from. Now, on to this week's episode. ''96 was an interesting year in American history. The country was celebrating its bicentennial. President Gerald Ford was locked in a presidential election race with the ex-governor of the state of Georgia, Jimmy Carter. The country was dealing with the end of the Vietnam War and the troops coming home in 1975, but it was also still dealing with the ramifications of a complete lack of trust in government due to the Watergate scandal and the resignations of both Vice President Spiro Agnew and President Richard Nixon only a few years earlier. Overseas in Great Britain, a rebellious sound was beginning to churn in the working class cities. It was embodied by groups such as The Clash, The Sex Pistols, etc. And right around the same time, that rebellious music was already churning in the belly of the Lower East Side of Manhattan in New York City at a club called CBGB's. The sound would get its name from a New York magazine called Punk. On Punk magazine's third cover, the cover story was about a group that had put out their debut album on April 23, 1976. The group The Ramones started out playing at Performance Studio in New York City in the middle of 1974 with original members Jeffrey Hyman, a.k.a. Joey Ramone, John Cumming, a.k.a. Johnny Ramone, Douglas Colvin, a.k.a. Dee Dee Ramone, and Thomas Erdely, a.k.a. Tommy Ramone. They had been playing gigs at Max's Kansas City nightclub and also CBGB's when they were seen by Hit Parader magazine's writer Lisa Robinson. She wrote an article on the group, then got former Stooges manager Danny Fields to become their manager. At 914 Sound Studio on September 19, 1975, the Ramones recorded a couple of songs for their demo tape, Judy is a Punk and I Want to Be Your Boyfriend, both of which were produced by Marty Thau. Based on the strength of their demo tape, along with a major push by producer and Ramones cheerleader Craig Leon, who had heard the band play and had fell in love with the band, the Ramones were signed to Sire Records by President Seymour Stein, who was only going to release another song that they had worked up called You're Gonna Kill That Girl. The Ramones said no, they didn't want to just release a song, and that they wanted to put out an album. So, Sire agreed, but at a really cheap price. Danny got Craig Leon, instead of Marty Thau, to produce their debut album. They used similar microphone placements during recordings to the way that the Beatles recorded in the early 1960s, with each instrument getting a separate microphone. They also did some overdubbing and doubled the vocals a lot. The only other musicians on the album were Joey Ramone's brother, Mickey Lay, and also producer Craig Leon, who both did some percussion instruments, and the band's engineer, Rob Freeman, did background vocals on the song I Want to Be Your Boyfriend. The album was recorded in January of 1976 at Plaza Sound Studio, which was on the 8th floor of Radio City Music Hall in Midtown. It had 14 songs on it with topics ranging from drug use to violence to even Nazism. The most well-known song on the album is probably Blitzkrieg Bop, which started out as a song about people having a good time at a concert and was originally called Animal Hop. Somewhere along the line, they decided that the song should instead be about Nazism and renamed the song. Beat on the Brat was about Joey Ramone wanting to beat up spoiled upper-class kids in his old neighborhood. Judy is a Punk is the shortest song on the album at a minute 32 and came to Joey as he passed by an apartment building where they would go up onto the roof and party. Joey also drew inspiration from the folk song, There Was an Old Woman Who Swallowed a Fly. I Want to Be Your Boyfriend was the band's homage to romantic ballads and used a glockenspiel as well as tubular bells. Chainsaw is the fastest song on the album and is an homage to horror movies, specifically the popular horror movie at the time, the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre, hence the circular saw in the beginning of the song. Now I Want to Sniff Some Glue's title inspired the title of the punk fan magazine Sniffin' Glue, and while the song is about kids being bored and sniffing household products, the Ramones themselves weren't about that life, contrary to popular belief, except for one, which we'll get to in a little while. I Don't Want to Go Down to the Basement is the longest song on the album at 2 minutes and 40 seconds and is another song that was inspired by horror movies. Fellow CBGB alum Debbie Harry of the group Blondie has also suggested that the song is about the basement at CBGB's, which was rather scary apparently. Loudmouth is a song that has four lines in it, or one long line, depending on how you're singing it. The song Havana Affair is a take on the old comic strip Spy vs. Spy, which used to show up in Mad Magazine a lot. That song goes right into Listen to My Heart, which is about a failing relationship. 53rd and 3rd was an autobiographical song that was written by Dee Dee Ramone and is about his time when he was younger as a male prostitute on the corner of 53rd Street and 3rd Avenue on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, servicing other men. The line where he kills one of his customers so he can prove that he's not a homosexual is not autobiographical. At least we don't think it is. Not sure. The Ramones recorded Craig Leon playing the Wurlitzer pipe organ at Radio City Music Hall for the group's cover version of the 1962 Chris Montez classic Let's Dance. I Don't Want to Walk Around With You was one of their songs that they wrote and was the first song on their demo tape. It's the next to last song on this album. The last song on the album, Today Your Love, Tomorrow the World, completes the whole Nazi theme that started with the first song, Blitzkrieg Bop, as this song is actually about a kid in the Hitler youth groups. The song originally had lyrics that offended Seymour Stein so much that he threatened not to put the song on the album. The lyrics that ended up on the album version are the lyrics that they all compromised on. But when you look at both versions of the lyrics, they don't really seem that far apart, truthfully. The original lines to the song are, quote, I'm a Nazi baby, I'm a Nazi, yes I am. I'm a Nazi shotzi, you know I fight for the fatherland. Now, the compromised lines are, I'm a shock trooper in a stupor, yes I am. I'm a Nazi shotzi, you know I fight for the fatherland. Somehow that's not much better or worse, truthfully. In any event, the total runtime of the album is 29 minutes and 4 seconds, and most of the songs, except for songs like I Want to Be Your Boyfriend, are raw and fast. It was recorded in 7 days, 3 days for the instruments, 4 days to lay down all the vocals. The album cost $6,400 to make, mainly due to the budget that Sire gave them. Told you they were going to do it on the cheap. But also because they really didn't need any more time or money than that to accomplish what they needed to. The front cover shot was photographed by punk magazine photographer Roberta Bailey, who was paid $125 for the shot. The now iconic and over-imitated shot of the band in black leather jackets and torn blue jeans, leaning up against a brick wall in Albert's Garden, which is a community garden between Bowery Street and 2nd Street in the Bowery section of Lower Manhattan, if you ever want to check it out yourself. While the back cover is of an Eagle belt buckle with the liner notes posted above it. The two singles that were officially released from the album were Blitzkrieg Bop, which was released in February of 1976, and I Want to Be Your Boyfriend, which was released in September of 1976. Both songs flopped, as did the album, which only made it to number 111 on the Billboard albums charts. Critically, though, The album was a smash hit, and over time it has become iconic, much like the band itself, who put out 14 albums in total before calling it quits in 1996. All of the original members are dead. Joey passed away from lymphoma in 2001. Dee Dee passed away from a heroin overdose in 2002. Like I said, he was about that life. Johnny passed away from prostate cancer in 2004, and Tommy was the last original member to pass away. He passed away from bile duct cancer in 2014. Producer Craig Leon, by the way, as of this recording, is still alive. He moved to England, and since 1998, he's been working on, of all things, classical music. Quite a far cry from his punk rock era. The debut album's influence is what makes the album number 33 on Rolling Stone magazine's Greatest Albums of All Time list, along with a lot of other best of lists. It announced punk rock music to the world. It influenced grunge and heavy metal, and it influenced The Clash and the Sex Pistols, focusing the British punk rock scene into what it finally became. Some critics even said that the Ramones saved rock music from its bloated form at the time and brought it back to the basics. All I know is that the album and the group have taken on almost mythic proportions, with people still wearing Ramones t-shirts just to make people think that they're cool. Of course, those are the same people who couldn't name more than two Ramones songs if their lives depended upon it. The debut album, The Ramones, by the legendary punk rock icons, The Ramones, released on April 23rd, 1976. Before we go any further, we'd like to tell you about our other podcasts. The Music History Today podcast goes over the daily events in music history and drops daily, including weekends, on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. There's also the Music Halls of Fame podcast, which talks about a member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, along with other Music Halls of Fame's museums and walks of fame. The Music Halls of Fame podcast drops every Thursday and can also be found on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to this podcast. To 54 West 54th Street in New York City has been many things over the decades. It started out as the Gallo Opera House, then the Casino de Paris, the WPA Federal Music Theater, the New Yorker Theater, then it was used as a TV studio, specifically TV Studio 52 for CBS, where it filmed shows such as Captain Kangaroo and the game show Password. However, when you think of that address, you don't really think of any of those things. You think of that brief 3-year period when the address became a modern-day Gomorrah. Studio 54, the nightclub, was started by Steve Rubell and Ian Traeger. Steve was the face of the club, the big ideas guy. Ian was the numbers guy, the gritty behind-the-scenes dude. Their idea was to make a no-holds-barred club with a mix of every type of person who would normally never be seen in a nightclub. Your usual college crowd, Wall Street types, were not going to cut it at this place. What made the club so hot was a number of things. First was the door policy, where Rubel and a couple of doormen would hand-pick who would get in and who wouldn't. You'd have drag queens partying it up some nights with preppies and celebrities. Second were those celebrities, thanks to the Rolodex of promoter and fashion public relations manager Carmen De Alessio. Michael Jackson, Elizabeth Taylor, Mick Jagger's jet-set wife Bianca Jagger, author Truman Capote, fashion designer Halston, artist Andy Warhol, Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis, and singer and actress Grace Jones were just some of the many celebrities that gave it its flamboyant style. Hamilton Jordan, who was White House chief of staff in the Carter administration during those years, famously created a scandal just for going to the club. Oh, and yes, the Donald and his then-wife Ivanka Trump would show up as well. Third was all the parties that they had there. No expense was spared for these outlandish events that became almost as legendary as the club itself. If it were a beach party, they'd import all the sand. During one party, they brought in a horse. Bianca Jagger got up on the horse and rode it around in the middle of the club for a little while, maybe a couple minutes, that's about it. But if there was an internet at that point in time, the photos of that moment would have broken it. The club was the epicenter for the disco scene. Artists from Gloria Gaynor to Donna Summer broke new records there. The band Chic was famously denied entry into the club, which led them to shout out the club and their experience in the song Le Freak. Studio 54 ran into problems from the very beginning. They were shut down by the liquor authority because they never legally applied for a liquor license. They were using daily caterer's licenses instead. They officially became a juice bar, but in reality, nothing really changed. Everybody knew what was up. People could still get their liquor, along with their cocaine and their other drugs. Some of the staff were even dealing drugs to celebrities and non-celebrities alike. There was also an awful lot of sex going on at the club. An awful lot of it, especially in the upper balconies. What ended up dooming Studio 54 wasn't any of that, surprisingly. However, if you know anything about history, much like Al Capone, it was tax evasion. Rubel and Schrager ended up in jail for a little over a year for tax evasion, and once out, they opened another hit club, the Palladium. Rubel passed away from complications from the AIDS virus on July 25, 1989. As for Schrager, he opened up a bunch of boutique hotels, which he still owns. And he was also pardoned by President Obama in 2017, literally just before Obama left office, literally the day before he left office. The club shut down on February 4th, 1980. To this day, I'm shocked that no other club anywhere from New York to Miami to Ibiza to even Las Vegas has tried some of the same things, from the crazy nightly parties to an anything-goes atmosphere. Its name, however, did live on, much like another New York City club that used to be around called CBGB's, in, of all places, Las Vegas. Studio 54 opened in the MGM Grand Hotel in 1997 and stayed open until 2012, when it closed to make way for a new nightclub, the extremely popular EDM Vegas club Hakkasan. The iconic nightclub Studio 54, which opened its doors on April 26, 1977. Let's finish off this podcast with a lot of honorable mentions. First, let's celebrate some birthdays and talk about three legends whose birthdays are this week. There are some people in the entertainment industry who become legends in one field. There are some who get really good in two fields. Anything more than that and you get into mythical status. Allow me to remind you of the greatness of this next mythical being. This person was born on April 24, 1942. She is a star in music, movies, television, and theater. She's a singer, songwriter, actress, screenwriter, director, producer, and composer. She is one of the biggest-selling female artists of all time. She has 10 Grammy Awards as well as a Lifetime Achievement and Legends Grammy Award. She held the record for the most top 10 albums by a female at 34, and also the most number one albums by a female at 11. If both of those records haven't been broken by now, I know of a couple of ladies who are really, really on track to break them very soon, except for maybe that 34 one. She is also the only artist to have a number one album in each of the last six decades. She has 53 gold albums, 31 platinum albums, and 14 multi-platinum albums to her credit. She began her career on Broadway while also making appearances on The Tonight Show and also in nightclubs. In 1963, she released her first two albums, which led to her starring role in the Broadway production of Funny Girl. She also starred in the movie version of the musical, which won her a Best Actress Oscar. She actually tied that year with Katharine Hepburn in one of the rare times that they've ever tied for a major award like that. As far as television goes, she has 5 Emmy Awards. Her first TV special premiered on April 28, 1965. She was given so much creative control that she performed every song herself and with no guest stars, and the special still became a ratings smash. She followed that up with 2 more TV specials. When it comes to movies, there's really no equal. She's won 2 Academy Awards, one for being the first female to win for Best Original Song. She's also the first woman to win a Golden Globe for Best Director and the first woman to star, direct, write, and produce the same movie. All total, to go along with her 10 Grammys, 5 Emmys, and 2 Oscars, she has a Special Tony Award, 4 Peabody Awards, a Kennedy Center's Honors, an American Film Institute Award, 9 Golden Globes, and a Presidential Medal of Freedom. Not bad for a kid from Brooklyn. She is the icon, the legend, Miss Barbara Streisand, born April 24th, 1942. This next woman was born in 1917 in Virginia. Her life had a very humble beginning, but despite facing hardships, including stints in juvie hall, her exceptional voice and unwavering determination propelled her to the pinnacle of jazz. She is Miss Ella Fitzgerald. Ella performed at her first amateur hour at the legendary Apollo Theater in New York City on November 21, 1934, at the age of 17. At the time, Ella was slated to dance. However, there was another dance act called the Edwards Sisters who were really good, and Ella was intimidated by them, so instead of dancing, she sang 2 songs. She won amateur night that night, and a legendary singing career was born. Also, first prize that night was $25. That's $578.97 in today's money, just in case you were wondering. After her win at the Apollo, her career skyrocketed. She joined the Chick Webb Orchestra, rising to become their lead vocalist. The band's success brought Fitzgerald national recognition, and her signature song, A Tisket a Tasket, became a timeless favorite. As Fitzgerald carved her own path, she collaborated with jazz legends like Duke Ellington, Count Basie, and Dizzy Gillespie. Throughout her career, she won 14 Grammy Awards and sold over 40 million albums, solidifying her place as a musical icon. She also won a Presidential Medal of Freedom and a National Medal of the Arts. Ella Fitzgerald's influence on jazz and American music is just completely undeniable. Her voice, a testament to dedication and also talent, continues to resonate with listeners worldwide, leaving an enduring mark on the world of music. Fitzgerald's prowess with her vocal skills is unmatched. Her tone was pure, her diction was impeccable, and her phrasing and timing were just out of this world exquisite. Her ability to improvise, particularly through scat singing, where she used her voice as an instrument, was just completely pioneering. She could sing pretty much anything, shifting from sultry ballads to a little bit on the playful jazz side, and all of it pretty effortlessly, truth be told. Beyond her musical genius, Fitzgerald was also a role model for resilience. Overcoming her childhood and also racial barriers, she paved the way for future generations of singers, and her philanthropic efforts to aid disadvantaged youth further cemented her legacy as an inspiring figure. The legendary Miss Ella Fitzgerald, born April 25th, 1917. This next legend is an activist, actor, poet, and author, as well as being great at his main jobs of being a singer-songwriter. He is one of the legends of country music, known for his outlaw lifestyle and long hair. His most recognizable albums are Shotgun Willie, The Redheaded Stranger, and Stardust. He wrote the country music classics Crazy for Patsy Cline and Funny How Time Slips Away. He had a popular duet called To All the Girls I've Loved Before. That was with Julio Iglesias. That's Enrique's father, for those of you who are too young to remember who Julio Iglesias is. He was part of the supergroup The Highwaymen with Waylon Jennings, Johnny Cash, and Kris Kristofferson. He has won 12 Grammy Awards and was recently inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. He is also an activist for legalizing marijuana and for the use of biofuels. He is country music legend Willie Nelson, born April 29th, 1933. Let's finish up the honorable mentions this week with some technology and also some Broadway. First off, back in the early 2000s, Napster had taken hold of the music industry and threatened to take it down, or at least make it extremely unprofitable for both record labels and artists. The record labels tried scaring their customers into paying overinflated prices for CDs and singles, but that only made people resent both the labels and also the artists like Metallica and Dr. Dre, who were all fighting against Napster at the time. Enter Apple CEO Steve Jobs, who saw an opening and also a huge opportunity. He famously got all of the record company heads together and explained the rules of the road to them. The first rule was that technology was going to win. Technology always wins. People found that it was obviously more convenient to carry around one small device that played millions of songs instead of a briefcase full of cassettes and CDs. No, literally, kids. There were briefcases full of cassettes and CDs. I know, I had them. That's how you carried around your music, especially when you were putting it into your car. Just saying. Anyway, the second rule of the road was that if record labels wanted to continue to be in business, then what they should really do is, instead of trying to fight technology, they should just open up a record store online and start selling their songs and albums in the new, extremely popular MP3 format. Jobs, of course, would take a nice little profit percentage for it. I mean, you know, nothing personal, strictly business. So, on April 28th, 2003, the culmination of that effort paid off when the iTunes Store premiered. Since that time, of course, books, videos, and now podcasts like this one have been added to the store. By the way, don't forget to like and subscribe to the podcast on Apple or wherever you get your audio and video podcast from. There's my brief little commercial. Anyway, iTunes changed the retail landscape. It's led to new business models like streaming services such as Spotify and Netflix. It has saved some industries like record labels, but it's also killed other industries like record stores. The convenience factor, though, can't be denied, and it is one of Steve Jobs' least celebrated achievements in an extremely stellar business career. That's kind of understandable when you consider that some of his other business achievements were, oh, I don't know, the iPod, the iPad, the Apple II computer, the iMac, Pixar, and of course the iPhone. Yeah, I guess you could probably overlook the iTunes Store as being huge, especially compared to all that. The first day of the iTunes Store, April 28th, 2003. Finally, the trio of Jerome Ragney, James Rado, and Galt McDermott wrote a musical about a group of hippies. They referenced drug use, hippie counterculturalism, sexuality, and nudity. These were not exactly normal fare for a Broadway musical, so it was pretty controversial, to say the least. Then again, it was the 1960s. Everything was controversial. Breathing was controversial. The musical went on to become a huge hit, with a few of the songs like Aquarius and Good Morning Sunshine becoming hits on the pop charts. That musical is Hair. which premiered on Broadway at the Biltmore Theater on April 29th, 1968. And that is it for the Music History In-Depth podcast for April 23rd through the 29th. Thanks for listening.